Maybe you don't utter the term every day, but we can bet the American dream is not a term unknown to you, and you could probably define it. So that's one term. Let's bring in another, America First. That's been said more often in the last couple of years, principally by President Trump. Does America First get us closer to the American dream? Plenty of people have thought so across a century and more. Sarah Churchwell examines the terms and their relationship in the book Behold America, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. Sarah is a Chicago native now living in London, where she teaches American literature and public understanding of the humanities at the University of London. Sarah Churchwell is editor or author of several previous books, including The Many Lives of Marilyn Monroe. Sarah, thanks for joining us today. Sarah, are you there?
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Oh, can you hear me?
I can, yeah. I'm glad to hear you're recovering from that cold that that kept you down last week.
Yeah. Sorry, I've still got it, so I'm pretty hoarse, but I hope everybody can hear me okay.
Yeah, we can hear you fine. So just in terms of timing, were you already at work on this book before Donald Trump listed his thoughts about the American dream and America First?
Well, I had been doing some of the research. Yes, I was sort of had the frame of reference in place, but it wasn't obvious that America First was going to be of the kind of widespread interest and influence that it now has. But I was aware the history, and I was working on the prehistory of the American dream. And then when he entered the frame, it became clear that this research that I had been doing in a more kind of academic context probably had, maybe more interest outside of those merely scholarly circles.
So if we think about the American dream in terms of people having the freedom to rise by their merits, I mean, is it really just an American dream? Isn't this something that a lot of people aspire to?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. So that would be the whole idea, right? Is that it's a universal dream, but the idea was that America was supposed to be unique, not in that its citizens had dreams. Obviously, if you say every human being has dreams, America was supposed to be unique in being a place that was uniquely devoted to helping individuals have the opportunity to realize those dreams, and particularly in the context of inherited privilege, inherited wealth, ideas of aristocracy and inherited power, that America was supposed to be the place where, regardless of your social position, of your parents' social position, that you could, if you worked hard and you had talent, that you would have the opportunity to make it in life. And then, of course, gradually over time, that idea started to kind of meld with the idea of America itself, as if American exceptionalism meant not only that America was a unique place in letting to the helping, but as if somehow, yeah, that only Americans dream of these kinds of things, which is becomes much more problematic.
So let's turn now to America First, just by way of introduction. Did that start with Charles Lindbergh and his isolationist pals before World War II?
No, actually, it didn't begin there. It almost ended there. It ended there really until Trump resuscitated the phrase. It actually began as a national catchphrase in 1915 when Woodrow Wilson used it to keep us not out of the Second World War, but out of the First. But Wilson was really using it in a different way. He wanted to find a way to articulate a notion of American neutrality as opposed to isolationism. Now, that might sound like splitting hairs, but it was an important distinction because Wilson wasn't saying we should completely stay out of Europe. And of course, he was a great internationalist and he was going to fight for the League of Nations. But he was saying that America should remain neutral so that it could be first to lead and first to help pick up the pieces, depending on, which side won. And that America could serve the interests of the world best by leading first and not necessarily taking one side or the other. So he was really trying to take this nuanced position. The phrase caught on like wildfire. It became a huge political slogan virtually overnight. And all of that nuance, that internationalist nuance about leadership that Wilson was trying to have the phrase imply, got lost in translation almost instantly. And it was taken up in the name of isolationism, in the name of domestic interest, in the name of saying, America, European conflict is not America's problem. we should look to our own interests first. And so although it wasn't coined to espouse a kind of nationalist selfishness, it very quickly got taken up in those terms. And all the way through the 1920s, it was an incredibly influential phrase. So it was the slogan of Wilson in his 1916 re-election campaign, but also of his Republican opponent on an America First campaign in 19, when Wilson's opponents wanted to keep the United States out of the Treaty of Versailles, out of the League of Nations. That was in the name of America First. When Warren Harding ran in 1920, he ran on an America First platform. In 1924, when a huge sweeping immigration act was passed, which had enormous consequences for the next several decades, known as the Johnson-Reed Act or the National Origins Act. That act was also debated on Congress in the name of America First. It was passed, signed in the name of America First. So it was an incredibly influential slogan for decades before Lindbergh and the America First Committee in the late 1930s gave it the iteration with which we're most familiar now.
It's really interesting to think that Woodrow Wilson, who was a man of many words, actually ended up getting undone by trying to hang on to a phrase of two words. So that's a problem with America First and how it got reinterpreted over time. America First and the American Dream are the dual focuses of Sarah Churchwell's book, Behold America, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. We'll come back and talk more with Sarah, and you can join the conversation by phone or email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Sarah Churchwell via Skype from London, talking about her book, Behold America, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. We're trying to figure out if those two terms are contradictory, complementary, or maybe different things at different times. You can join the conversation on the phone at 800-838-3760, or you can join us by email on the exchange, jx@jeffnet.org. So at the first utterances of America First, was it seen as something complementary, a means to realize the American dream, Sarah?
Well, the American dream as a phrase at that point in the 19-teens and 20s, we're talking about now, didn't really have the traction that it has today. We're basically talking about the period in which Scott Fitzgerald was writing The Great Gatsby, which, of course, would now talk about as, you know, probably the preeminent novel of the American dream. But if you had said to Scott Fitzgerald, is this novel about the American dream, he wouldn't really have known what you meant. The phrase was on the rise, but it wasn't a national catchphrase yet. Certainly, the people using America First at that time were using it to try to bring about what they saw as, you know, their vision of what America should be, what its identity ought to be, what it should look like, image of what that was. And that's a pretty familiar image. So they were there is a recognizable version of an American dream in there that they were trying to bring about. But it wouldn't be what we mean by the American dream at all. For the most part, the people who took up America First in those decades, in the early decades of the 20th century, it was most prominent, as I say, as a political slogan. It was used by several presidential candidates, including by several Republicans in a row. But it was also very prominently associated with the resurgent Ku Klux Klan, which had reformed in 1915, and was gaining power all the way through the 20s in ways that I think we sometimes have lost sight of, and we're not always clear. We think of the KKK perhaps as a Southern phenomenon, but by the mid-1920s, they bragged that they had mayors from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon, from coast to coast. Lynching was spreading up from the South. There were double lynchings in Duluth, Minnesota in the 20s, in Oakland, California. So it was not something that was restricted to the South. And America First was one of their favorite slogans. They actually claimed in the late 1920s that they had copyrighted it, that it was, you know, kind of their catchphrase, which wasn't true, but they firmly associated themselves with it. And their version of America First was quite explicitly a white nationalist, white supremacist version of America First. And in the 20s, a very anti-immigrant, xenophobic America First as well. And of course, it was anti-Semitic too.
Yeah, we know about the KKK in Oregon. It did actually run very strongly in Oregon into the 1920s and had control of most of the state legislature at one time. So very, very much a force in Oregon a century ago. And so while we're on the 1920s, the prologue in your book covers Memorial Day in 1927 in New York City. And boy, Brooklyn in 1927 sounds like Portland a couple of weeks ago.
So there was I think we, again, in terms of how we tend to think about our own history, I think there's a tendency, I certainly had it until I really dove into the research of this book, to think of fascism as a pretty much a European phenomenon. And of course, to recognize that there have always been right-wing extremist groups in America, but not necessarily to think of them as self-styled fascist groups, or if they were, that they were very, you know, they were very wing, groups, and they never had a lot of influence, that they were fringe groups. So that's not really the case. And the fact is that the people who would refer to themselves as fascists, both as in a kind of homegrown American style of fascism that was gaining popularity in the 1920s, and we should say that the Klan was very clearly recognized as a fascist organization by Americans around the country. And indeed, they themselves saw the affinity in the early 20s. There was a great deal of talk about them actually trying to create some kind of alliance with Mussolini explicitly. And so this affinity between the Klan and European fascism in the early 20s was widely recognized. But there were also fascists who supported Mussolini as such in the United States, of course, Italian nationals and others. And by 1927, those groups were starting to get a lot of political prominence. And in 1927 in New York, they were given the right to march in a variety of Memorial Day parades that year. So in Brooklyn, there was a group of Italian fascists who marched across Brooklyn and gave the kind of Mussolini salute in front of the Italian flag. And there were Italian fascists in Manhattan who intended to join the Memorial Day parade there. And then in Queens, the Klan was very controversially given a permit to march as part of the Memorial Day parade. And this what resulted in a riot has since sometimes been described erroneously as a Klan rally, which it wasn't. It was a Memorial Day parade, a normal Memorial Day parade with veterans groups and, you know, the Red Cross and students and what have you, a benign Memorial Day parade. But the Klan was given a permit in Queens and allowed to join the parade. And there were 20,000 spectators, just, you know, again, normal Americans out watching the parade. And scuffles broke out among the bystanders over whether the KKK should have been permitted to march. Out of those 20,000, these scuffles became a riot. The police were called. And out of those 20,000, there were 6 arrests, of whom 5 were self-identified Klansmen. And the 6th was a man named Fred C. Trump, who would go on to have a son who would become the president. Now, as I say, this has been described sometimes as Fred Trump's presence at a Klan rally. That's not accurate. And it's not clear he was there to support the Klan. But it is remarkable that only 6 people out of 20,000 were arrested. 5 of them were Klansmen. And one of the things I say in my book is that, you know, though we can't say with any certainty that Fred Trump was a card-carrying Klansman, and there's not any evidence to suggest that he was, there's also no evidence there to protest the Klan. Later record in terms of accusations of racism that would be levied against him would suggest that he wasn't there to protest the Klan. Sorry about the bell behind. That wasn't supposed to go off, but it should stop in a second.
Sarah Churchwell is our guest in the exchange. Her book is Behold America. The book is it actually goes back before 1927 and Fred Trump and the Klan. And there are 3 major parts to the book, starting with the 1900 to 1920 segment. So give us the overview of that period. 1900 was the heart of the progressive era, which was about what?
It was a pushback against the Gilded Age, the robber barons, and indeed growing inequality. And there are a lot of parallels between the end of the Gilded Age and the turn into the Progressive Era and today. It was a time of variety of monopoly capitalism, which would become capitalism, really entrenching itself. It was actually that era that gave us the phrase, the metaphor of the 1% and the 99%. We didn't invent that one either. There was a sense that too few people had control of too much wealth, and that was putting a stranglehold on opportunity. We were talking a minute ago about America, you know, supposing to be the country that would guarantee people's opportunity to pursue prosperity. And what they were seeing was that opportunity was increasingly being restricted to the few and not to the many. And that became known as the progressive era, the attempt to bring certain kinds of government reforms, to say that it couldn't just dog-eat-dog individualism, that the state needed to be brought in to protect all people's rights to, liberty and justice for all, that couldn't just be left on its own. And you see, this is the era of things like Teddy Roosevelt, trust busting, McKinley. The decision, in the name, by the way, of republicanism, of smaller republicanism, to break up big monopolies, to break up the trusts, in order to make sure that small business people still had opportunities as well, that the individual also had opportunity. And that is actually the moment that gave birth to the phrase, the American dream, which really doesn't exist in the 19th century in any or before in any way that we would recognize. Certainly not to describe a national value system or a collective ethos. But it began to be used in those years as the progressive era tried to find a way to push back against monopoly capitalism taking over democracy. In the sense that inequality would destroy the democratic experiment because not everybody would have equal access to liberty, to justice, to democracy, and that the rich could entrench those privileges, and indeed then that those would be inherited by and you would replicate a European model of aristocracy. And so what they said was, we need to have some kind of regulation, we need to fight back against this, we need to have some checks on this rampant monopoly capitalism, or they said it will destroy the American dream of democracy, the American dream of opportunity, the American dream of liberty, of justice. And when you think about it in those terms, rather than the way that we tend to use it, the American dream of individual prosperity, of upward social mobility, of rags to riches, it actually makes sense because, of course, the founding ideals of the country were about those values of, democracy, justice, liberty, self-government, and that they saw that those principles would be threatened by a country that just said, it's a free-for-all and the state has no role in protecting you from depredations of, the rich guy down the street who might be able to entrench his privilege. And so that was where the American dream came from. It was in an argument about inequality, but it was on the other side of the argument from the way that we use it today. And one of the things that surprised me the most in my research was that in the first 3 decades or 4 decades of the growing use of the American dream as a national catchphrase, I never once found it used to defend free market capitalism, not a single time. And of course, today it's all but synonymous with free market capitalism, but they were using it to argue the opposite case.
Interesting. So it's become much more of an economic thing over time. Sarah Churchwell has been exploring this realm of the American dream and America First and how they relate to each other. Her book is called Behold America, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. Sarah is joining us by Skype from London, so you can hit the occasional computer hits there. But you can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what kinds of ideas did people have? And you mentioned Teddy Roosevelt and trust busting. So was there some? Is this where the original income tax came from in 1913? Out of this idea that we shouldn't have an aristocracy?
How do we begin to in a democratic way, and what they would have called republicanism with a small r, not anything to do with the GOP as such, but what we might now refer to broadly as social democracy, or the welfare state. They were starting to build the structures that would eventually lead to the New Deal. We had never had any kind of government protections for individuals. Indeed, Grover Cleveland said in his second inaugural address that that the people were there to support the government, but the government was not there to support the people. So there was this idea that paternalism would destroy American individualism, and that the government should absolutely in no way be there to support individuals. But that was an idea very much under debate. People were starting to push back against that idea and to say, well, you know, individuals may need protection from the state against other individuals, which of course is what law is. You know, I mean, that's what we do in principles of criminal law in terms of justice. And they were starting to say, look, if you've got able to gain so much power through, you know, the what may or may not be technically legal, or indeed in some cases, you know, the robber barons were pretty brazenly breaking laws. Corruption was, of course, rampant during the Gilded Age. I mean, this is the age of the bosses, of people like Boss Tweedy and Tammany Hall. I mean, Boss Tweed, sorry, and Tammany Hall. So that, you know, it's an age of rampant corruption. And people were looking around saying, of course, we need the government to protect us from these people are cheating and they're amassing huge, fortunes that then they can, you know, use to continue to rig the game on their side. And so that was when people started to advocate for ideas like income tax, for, you know, various other kinds of regulations, for particularly the antitrust laws, to say that you have to protect competition, you have to start to think about distributing wealth in a kind of socialist idea, but making sure that opportunity continues to be distributed fairly, equally, and to be fighting for principles of egalitarianism, which that kind of rampant inequality is obviously going to hugely threaten and endanger.
When we look at the difference between the American Dream and America First, the American Dream was never really a political slogan, it seems, but America First always was. I mean, we talked about how Woodrow Wilson used the phrase to whip up support for the war, and I'm curious in particular, Woodrow Wilson certainly has left his mark on federal government as a racist and had Birth of the Nation screened in the White House. Did he intend the nativist use of America First? Is that possible to even determine?
No, it's not possible to determine, I don't think, exactly. But there's no evidence to suggest that he did want it to be used that way or intend it to be used that way. So I think on that aspect, we can probably give him the benefit of the doubt in one sense. But it is certainly true, as you say, he's now, you know, well recognized as somebody who supported segregation. He was the person who brought the federal government and didn't just leave it to the states. And he was, of course, himself the son of slaveholders in Virginia. So he was, he was very much a segregationist way of thinking. And that whole logic, I would say, is a logic that he was very comfortable with. So he didn't necessarily, or that it just was like second nature to him, right? It was the world that he breathed. So he didn't necessarily have to intend it. The thing was that America First slotted so neatly into those kinds of ideologies, those sorts of precepts, because it went hand in glove very quickly with another catchphrase, which is less popular now, but was equally popular with America First then, which was 100% American. And that phrase, 100% American, they basically used that the way we would use, quote unquote, real American. So it's a deeply coded statement, right? So if you say, oh, so-and-so is a real American, and the implication is that somebody else is less real of an American, and then you kind of think, well, but hang on, what does that really mean? Are you saying that they're an imaginary American, or that they're suspiciously foreign, that they have suspiciously foreign ideas or a foreign name, or they have some loyalty to some other group? And those kinds of ideas that you weren't putting America first was associated with this idea 100% American, and what was also known at the time, again, another idea that we tend to think we have a monopoly on, but that they were the first ones to talk about, the idea of what was called hyphenate identity. And they meant exactly what it sounds like, that if you were Italian American or Irish American or German American, they worried that you were insufficiently loyal to the United States and you might have a higher loyalty to, you know, Ireland or Germany, or indeed to the Pope if you were Catholic. Or if you were, that you might have a higher loyalty to the internationalist global cabal that you were supposed to be a part of higher loyalty would be to money in those, you know, ancient anti-Semitic tropes. So these ideas that somehow to be a hybrid American, a hyphenate American, was somehow less American than other kinds of Americans, converged this idea of putting America first, of being the right kind of American, being 100% American, and being 100% American picked up on the whole history of the code of the one-drop rule. The one-drop rule, of course, they the law that said that one drop of Negro blood made you legally a Negro, and therefore legally subject to slavery up until emancipation, and then after emancipation, legally subject to Jim Crow.
All right, back with Sarah Churchwell and Behold America in 1 minute here on the Jefferson Exchange. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're getting an education on American Dream and America First and how those two terms tend to collide and bounce off each other through the course of American history, primarily from the 20th century forward. Behold America is Sarah Churchwell's book, subtitled The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. She's joining us from London on a Skype connection, which occasionally burps just a little bit, so bear with us as we get the auto-tune sounds and some of the other features of a Skype connection, because Sarah's doing a good job informing us about the contents of her book, about the fact that the American Dream didn't mean just economic success for a long time. And America First is quite a bit older than Donald Trump and even predates the First World War by quite a few years. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So this America First movement goes through the First World War, and we win the First World War, and everybody's feeling pretty good about that. But then immediately after the war, there's this Red Scare and a fear of socialism. Did that strengthen the case for America First, or was that just a creation of America First?
That strengthened the case for America First. America First was a reaction to all of these kind of quote-unquote alien ideas, these un-American or anti-American ideas, as we would have them now. I mean, this kind of binary that we like to set up, where there's, you know, these things are, you know, truly American or 100% American or pure American or all American. And then there are these things that are un-American, that are anti-American. Yeah. So Breyer was very much, it was, many people were legitimately worried about it. It wasn't a kind of, you know, manufactured, cynical anxiety. A lot of people thought it was genuinely worrying that there might be a Bolshevik revolution. But for a lot of people, it also became a way to exploit those fears, and to and particularly in disputes with labor at the time, a lot of as you might expect, as was the case in Europe as well, a lot of the people who were drawn to socialist ideas were in the working class, were in the laboring forces, and they were, you know, trying to bring the fight to the forces of rampant capitalism, of what would become corporate capitalism. And so people, agitators, you know, would brand them as red, as commie sympathizers, as pinkos. And, you know, I think one of the things that not enough Americans realize is that victims of lynching in the early decades of the 20th century were not only African Americans. There were actually many people who were lynched for being accused of having a socialist or communist sympathies. So it was a very real threat, and it absolutely fed into the idea that America First should be how we push back against all of these foreign ideas and foreign people in an infiltrating American with their alien values. America First was a wide umbrella, you know, broad church to push back against anything that somebody might construe as un-American by their definition, what they wanted America to mean.
Well, there were critics of America First, Sinclair Lewis and other writers. In fact, you talk about quite a few writers contemporary to those times as we go through the book. Sinclair Lewis in particular, though, carved up America First in Babbitt, his novel in 1920. And what did he do to America Firsters?
Yeah, so Babbitt is a satire of a kind of complacent middle American businessman who is who's an unthinkingly tribal Republican. He's pro-business. He thinks that, you know, he worships business, and that's Lewis's metaphor, not mine. Abbott kind of unthinkingly worships at the altar of business and thinks that making money is the only thing that matters. And Lewis has a little bit of fun skewering America First as part of that. America First in traction. And so he has some passing swipes at it in Babbitt. Babbitt is mostly a satire of kind of a knee-jerk Republican belief in commerce and in business as the American way, as the only value that America should care about, and this kind of crass commercialism that was taking over. But as the ideas associated with America First, this kind of xenophobia and right-wing authoritarianism, white nationalism, eventually supremacism, began to really cohere around America First. It really continued to gain traction, and it continued to gain prominence until by the early 1930s, there were a lot of self-styled American fascist groups, including one that called itself America First Incorporated, that were explicitly espousing a European-style fascism. We, of course, had an American Nazi Party as well, and they would call themselves 100% American. They would say that they believed in America for Americans. Again, a coded idea that there was the right kind of American and the wrong kind of American. And Sinclair Lewis wrote another book taking them on much more explicitly about the idea of America First as it exists now in his 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here, in which he imagines what an American fascism would look like, that an American fascism would be very much bound up in ideas about shipping dollar, about corporate interests taking over politics, and that's what an American authoritarian fascism would look like. So it's a topic that Lewis came back to more than once.
It's interesting the parallels that you draw between that time and this. I mean, the use of the term America First is certainly abroad in the land. There is some intolerance toward people who are not considered American enough. Then, as now, the Republican Party controlled White House and the Congress after the 1920 election. And there's another parallel that you point out that you can't miss here, the perception that Democrats could not get their act together.
Exactly. And that was true, certainly, throughout the 1920s, is that the Democrats just could not mount a decent opposition. It's worth remembering that the Reagan administration was brought down by the Dome scandal, which was the greatest political corruption scandal until Watergate, still the greatest political bribery scandal in American history. And yet, the Republicans kept getting reelected. It wasn't sufficient to get the Republicans out of office. Now, that was partly because Calvin Coolidge, Harding's vice president, was famously upright, and he did not pardon the people involved in the Teapot Dome scandal. So there was a feeling that although he was a Republican, he was upholding law and order, and so he was kind of getting, you know, the house in order, national house in order. But there was also, as you say, a very clear degree to which the Democrats couldn't get themselves together. Now, it's important to remember that in the 1920s, the Democrats were still, by and large, the party of the Southern agrarian Democrats, and indeed the party of the KKK. So it was not the Democratic Party that we would recognize today. And we don't necessarily lament. Some of those Democrats didn't get presidential or full congressional power. I mean, the KKK had enough, as you mentioned earlier, the degree of influence they had in states like Oregon. You know, we know that their degree of greatest penetration was in the West, in Indiana and in Illinois. And if the Southern Democrats had actually managed to create some kind of coalition with Northern Democrats, then that would mean that we would have had another generation of explicit white segregationists, you know, in Congress and in the White House. So, you know, we don't necessarily want to romanticize what that might have looked like, as if that would have, you know, saved us from the Republican crash. I mean, it played out. But the parallel is still worth noting. That it is just a question of the Republicans are creating policies that are good for all Americans, but whether the Democrats can mount a reasonable opposition. A lot more in a week, won't we?
Yeah, we will. We will, indeed. I want to talk about the culmination then of America Firstism in the mid 20s. The National Origins Act passed in 1924. Give us a sketch of what that did.
Yeah, the National Origins Act was an immigration act that had really profound consequences. It was in the National Origins. It was called, as I said, the National Origins Act, and that gives you an indication of what it was about. It was a quota system that was based on your nation of origin and on ethnicity quite explicitly. It was a eugenicist act. It gave the most places to people of Northern European heritage, and it sought to ruthlessly restrict or in some cases exclude altogether the ability of other ethnicities, of people from Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, Africa, or Asia to enter the United States at all, or if they did enter, to do so in very, very small quotas. This, of course, is a time when the Chinese Exclusion Act was still in law. It was the 1924 National Origins Act put a huge strain on America's relationship with Japan, for example, because it almost entirely excluded Japanese. It put a huge limit on, on Eastern Europeans, and particularly on Jews from Eastern Europe. And that law was in effect until Johnson reversed it in 1965. And what that meant was that, for example, in 1939 and 1940, when Jews in Eastern Europe were fleeing the Holocaust, that was the reason why the United States turned them away, because we already had enough German Jews and we weren't taking any more. We already had enough Poles and we weren't taking any more. And so we turned ships like the St. Louis in 1939 back to Europe, turned refugees away, sent them back to the Holocaust. And in the case of the famous case of a ship like the St. Louis, 50% of those refugees went on to die, and because they were sent back, they were sent to concentration camps. They died in the Holocaust, and that was because of a law that was passed in 1924 in the name of America First. So I think that we have a tendency right now to think about this as empty rhetoric, they all phrase, and people are. Social media, people saying, it's just, come on, it's innocently patriotic. And, there's nothing wrong with saying we're putting America first. Why are you saying that that's in any way objectionable? And I'm saying that there is a really dark and ugly history here that we should be aware of before we resuscitate this kind of phrase. And we should also be aware that the people around Trump know what this phrase means. People may argue whether Trump knows it or doesn't know it. But for example, Miller, who of course is the one behind the current policy of abducting children at the border if their parents are undocumented, he wrote in his high school yearbook that he was 100% American, which is associated with this idea of America First. Steve Bannon has called for economic nationalism, the protectionist tariff that they called for with America First in 2019. These guys back and they're rediscovering these old policies and these old platforms, and they want to bring them back. That for certain audiences, of course, lots of Americans today are using this phrase innocently. I think the majority are using it innocently. But the question is that a phrase that we want people to use innocently and to defend? Or do we want to tell the truth about its dark history and to say this is something we don't want to bring back, particularly when it does have these very strong associations with white nationalism? And that we have a president who said last week that he defiantly called himself a nationalist. And whatever we may think about his kind of nationalism, the other decisions that he's made and the other kinds of things that he said make clear how consistent his version of nationalism is with this older idea of America First that I'm talking about. So the analogy I always use is the really obvious one of Heil Hitler. If you met somebody who genuinely didn't know what Heil Hitler meant, they would be using it innocently, sure. But would you just say, oh, okay, you don't know, carry on, that's innocent enough? Or would you sit them down and say, okay, let me explain to you the terrible history of this phrase that you're using in hopes that you won't want to use it anymore? And that's what I was trying to do in telling this history of America First.
We just have about 30 seconds left. I mean, is there a particular version of the American dream that you're happiest with, that resonates most with you?
Yeah, the one that that I was the most surprised and the most pleased to find was that in the 1930s, in these debates about the gaining authoritarianism and white nationality, the rise of fascism, and whether America should enter the European conflict, but the American dream. People, I should say, as well as left, were arguing in the American cultural conversation in the 30s, in the name of the American dream, against anti-Semitism. And they were arguing against racism. And they were saying, if we allow anti-Semitism, for example, to take hold in America, that will be the end of the American dream of justice and opportunity and egalitarianism. And I think in the wake of the, you know, terrible violence in Pittsburgh this weekend, that would be a meaning that you know, I could wholeheartedly reclaim, mm-hmm. to say the American dream was supposed to be of inclusion and tolerance, and we can go back to that.
All right, Sarah Churchwell, the author of Behold America, The Entangled History of America First and the American Dream. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me and for putting up with the glitches.
Oh, sure.